From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. A lot going on in the upper chamber of Congress today. The hopes of a filibuster-proof Senate for the Democrats has been shattered, at least on paper. That after Republican Senator Saxby Chambliss defeated Democratic challenger Jim Martin in yesterday's Georgia runoff. The man appointed governor of New York is now going to have to appoint Hillary Clinton's Senate replacement. But who? And the president-elect names another cabinet secretary while the outgoing president goes public with a candid assessment of his 8 years in the White House. Here to help us break down and through the latest political news is Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Robert George, associate editorial page editor for the New York Post. Hello, everybody. How
Hello
are you?
Hello there, Tony. Hello.
Hey,
there,
Tony. Nice
Robert.
To hear from you.
Nice to have you back with me again. Let's talk about topic number one. Republican Senator Saxby Chambliss won a decisive victory Tuesday over Democrat Jim Martin, as we said, in the Georgia Senate runoff race. Robert, Chambliss ran on a platform of limiting the power of Democrats in Congress specifically. How much did the notion of the Democrats having full control of the Senate influence the voters, do you think?
I would guess it would probably had a lot to do with it. I mean, keep in mind, it was Georgia has this little unique runoff situation where you have to have 50 plus one to actually get to actually win, or it goes to the runoff. So it's not surprising that Chambliss won in that kind of a setting. But I think the idea that not only do you have a Democrat in the White House, but you've got at least 58 Democratic senators and large numbers in the House. The idea of putting at least some kind of a check on the power of the Democrats was probably appealing to a number of what is still a rather conservative electorate in Georgia.
You know, interesting, I think, Mary, is this. Even had Martin won and even had the Democrats been able to get what they considered a filibuster-proof number at 60, there's no guarantee of any of that with people crossing the aisles these days, is there?
Absolutely. And besides, two of those 58 are independents, Bernie Sanders and Joe Lieberman, but they vote caucus with the Democrats. But also, you've got Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins from Maine, who are more liberal Republicans, and the Democrats have Mary Landrieu from Louisiana and Ben Nelson.
And Ben Pryor from Arkansas, too.
Yes. They've got folks who are in the middle. What it really means is that the constraint on who to nominate for the courts is that you can't Obama, if he were to choose to do so, and I don't think he would do it anyway, won't choose anyone who's not sort of a centrist, a sort of moderate centrist, because there's always the danger that people will feel like they need to filibuster. And it also will have a constraint on some of the legislation, but for some of it, it won't make any difference because Collins and Snowe have already said that they're in favor of a lot of things that are on Obama's plate. But people just have to understand that there are Democrats who are moderate, who vote the way moderate and to the right Republicans vote, and there are Republicans who vote the way liberal Democrats
Absolutely.
Do.
Absolutely. Robert, let me follow up with one other question on this before we go to topic two, and that's this. Sarah Palin, we're not going to talk about her, but this is just the introduction
Let's talk
to it.
About
okay.
It.
Sarah Palin went down to Georgia to stump on behalf of Chambliss, and I believe that Bill Clinton did as well, but no Obama, and there's been some question as to whether or not he should have or should not have. Do you think that the president-elect threw the Democratic challenger under the bus?
No, I think I would not be the one giving him advice, but I think he was very smart. If you look at the electorate, Georgia is still a red state. Had he gone down there and helped, say, pump up some of his supporters, got more of the black vote out, he would have narrowed it. And so instead of being a 58-42 win, it would have might have been 55-45 or something like that. But the downside would have been he would have expended political capital in a race that the Democrat was definitely going to be behind anyway. So I think he was very smart just to let it play out.
Mary, you know, I asked him and not you that question, but I'm going want to move on to another topic. I've got something better for you. Okay. President-elect tapped New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson for the Commerce Cabinet post today, introducing him this morning. I was struck by a question during a news conference from a Latino reporter who asked why Richardson didn't get a better position, his words, in the administration, to which the president-elect answered, quote, commerce is a pretty good job. What do you make of the Richardson choice?
Well, the questioner is quite correct. I remember when Bill Clinton appointed Ron Brown, who had chaired the DNC and has helped him to get elected president, to be Secretary of Commerce. A number of us were asking why Ron didn't get a better post. Ron himself was asking why he didn't get a more prestigious post. There's a pecking order in the cabinet, and commerce is not, you know, one of the top departments. It is a very good post, and it has a lot of possibilities, and I'm sure that Bill Richardson will, in fact, take advantage of the possibilities and do a good job. He deserves something because he switched sides, even though he owed his whole career in public life to the Clintons, who appointed him to, Bill Clinton appointed him to U.N. ambassador and Secretary of Energy and the like. And
well, let me jump in to ask you this. What about that? Because the fact that he turned and was called a Judas and other bad things
by James Carville.
And Bill Clinton was not very happy with him as well. Is that a potential point of friction on the Obama team?
No, it's campaign stuff. I mean, campaign rhetoric. People say all kinds of things and call people all kinds of names and the like, and the public has to understand that it's campaign rhetoric, and when it's over, now people just move on.
All right.
Well, it may be, I would say, though, that if you're Richardson, though, you might be find it a little bit galling, though, that you're probably more qualified to be Secretary of State than, I mean, just in terms of your resume, than, say, Hillary Clinton, and then Hillary Clinton got Secretary of State instead, so that might be a little bit frustrating.
You could argue that Bill Richardson, by switching sides like that, even though he owed everything to the Clintons, that one might be a little skeptical about his consistency if you were Obama. I don't know if that's the case.
That's an interesting point, Mary. Yeah. All right, I got another topic talking about Hillary Clinton, as a matter of fact. Let's follow it up with this, because now that she has officially been nominated for Secretary of State, the big question is, who is going to replace her? Now, the list of potential candidates is long and growing. The names Cuomo, Kennedy Jr., even Bill Clinton. My question, Robert, for you is there pressure? How much pressure is there on New York Governor David Paterson to pick a particular person?
Well, of course there's a lot of, you know, New York obviously is a place, as you may have heard, is a place of lots of egos. And so in just the names that you rattled off there, you know, it sounds like if you have to have a good family name even just to get to first base on this whole selection process. There's a lot of, Bill Clinton has basically ruled himself out, by the way, as has Bobby Kennedy, as has Bobby Kennedy Jr. But there is a lot of jockeying back and forth. Andrew Cuomo is definitely a name that has been popped around a lot, and that might be a kind of a twofer, because it's a big enough name that it fits into a slot that has been previously occupied by Hillary Clinton and a Daniel Patrick Moynihan and a Robert Kennedy and so forth. At the same time, it also conveniently moves Cuomo out of the way of challenging David Paterson potentially in a Democratic gubernatorial primary in 2 years. Other names that have been put around are Nydia Velazquez, because some people believe it's time that there's an Hispanic gets a Senate position in New York. So there's definitely a lot of jockeying. Yesterday, Governor Paterson announced kind of an advisory council that's going to be helping him with it, including Charles Schumer, Charlie Rangel, Congressman Gregory Meeks, and a couple of other people. So, we've got more than a month before he has to make a selection, because Hillary Clinton said she's not going to be giving up the seat until she is formally approved by the Senate.
Well, you know, I would think, Mary, given the fact that Hillary Clinton was in that position, how powerful she was, how popular she was, and how she came within a whisker of being the Democratic nominee for president, that a female would have to be put in that position? Would you think that's
right? I've heard that what David Patterson really needs is a Latina Jewish woman who is a leader in the disability rights movement and happens to come from upstate New York.
Bingo.
I don't know anybody like that. So I don't think there's any great pressure to actually some people have talked about Nita Loy as another person. But Andy Cuomo looks to me like he's the front runner, because I saw a poll that showed that in New York State, most people hadn't heard of any of the other people they were talking about. So he started out with that advantage. And it does keep him from running for governor, which is next logical thing after you've been attorney general in New York.
Now, but of course, there's some of these interesting kind of stuff going on behind the scenes here, because the scuttlebutt amongst the various political types is that Charles Schumer, who has been the senior senator from New York mm-hmm. for several years, has been kind of chafing under the bit about having been in the shadow of Hillary Clinton, who is technically the junior senator, and he would rather have somebody who would clearly give deference to him as the senior senator. Andrew Cuomo does not fit that category. So
I'm not sure Charles Schumer has that kind of ego. He's widely known for not having an ego.
I hope our listeners got the sarcasm.
That was really obviously an interesting observation on your part, and one that would be interesting for him. I mean, consider the fact that David Patterson wasn't even elected to the position that he is in. He fell into it through the back door, and now he gets to make this appointment as well.
Tony, you should keep in mind, just to show you how potentially dysfunctional the New York government will look like, if Andrew Cuomo is selected as a senator, it would mean that all three statewide offices in New York would be filled with people who were not elected
right,
to those positions.
Who were appointed, absolutely. And let me ask you both to hold on. We have a lot more to talk about, including President Bush's appearances on ABC television talking about his 8 years. We're going to come back with that conversation in just a moment. This is News and Notes, and I'm Tony Cox. We're back talking about politics with Robert George, Associate Editorial Page Editor for the New York Post, and Mary Frances Berry, Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. So let's get right back into it. I want to talk about the president, ladies and gentlemen. Back in 2004, President Bush was asked what the biggest mistake of his administration was, and he had difficulty coming up with an answer.
I wish you'd have given me this written question ahead of time so I could plan for it. John, I'm sure historians will look back and say, gosh, he could have done it better this way or that way. I'm sure something will pop into my head here in the midst of this press conference, all the pressure of trying to come up with an answer, but it hadn't yet.
All right, let's fast forward 4 years. President Bush now preparing to exit the White House, and in an interview with ABC's Charles Gibson, the president was much more reflective about the shortcomings of his administration.
I don't know. I mean, the biggest regret of all the presidency has to have been the intelligence failure in Iraq. A lot of people put their reputations on the line and said, the weapons of mass destruction is a reason to remove Saddam Hussein. It wasn't just people in my administration. And, that's not a do-over, I wish the intelligence had been different, I guess.
So, Robert, what's the difference?
Well, the difference is he had 4 years to get the answer this time. He said he wanted a little bit of a preparation. This time he had 4 years for it. To give the president a certain amount of due. I mean, when you're leaving office, you're in a sense leaving the political life and you're moving into the post-presidential statesman life. And so you can be a little bit more candid about, certain failings and so forth. And I think that's what you're seeing here. And basically there is there's a complete and total broad assessment, whether it's conservatives, liberals, whatever, that, the intelligence on Iraq was clearly wrong. And so, I mean, in a sense, that's a safe answer. I mean, he's not going to go so far as to say that, you know, it was a mistake to go into Iraq. And he's definitely sticking to his guns on that. So, in a sense, it's an accurate thing to say, but it's also a safe choice as well.
Well, Mary, he said that he was proud that he did not compromise his principles. So is this a changed man or the same man speaking with different words now?
Well, I think it's the same man because, remember, 2004, yes, it was 4 years ago, and also we were at a different place in the war in Iraq then than we are now in terms of the policy and what was happening on the ground and all the rest. And the debate in the country about whether there were weapons of mass destruction, whereas most people believed there were still a lot of conservatives who kept insisting that there were weapons. The timing was entirely different. There's no advantage to him now to keep on, as Robert said, saying that, you know, he believes there are, there were, when in fact everybody, I mean, there's consensus now broadly. And I did note that he is sticking by his principles. He said that going into the war, he didn't repudiate that. He thinks it was still a good idea to go into Iraq. I didn't hear him repudiate any of his policy positions on any of the issues. He was just more candid about his own thinking, saying that he wasn't prepared to be a war president when he came in. He was talking about events and not himself, you know, personally, and how events overtake presidents. So I think it's right that he stuck by his principles. Maybe he shouldn't have in some cases, but I think he did.
One of the things that his wife said during the interview was that she has had people come up to her thanking her on behalf of her husband for keeping America safe. Do you think the public generally feels that way, Robert?
I think that when you assess a presidency, you have to look at the complete picture, and the fact that there has not been any kind of a follow-up attack on U.S. soil since 9/11, I think accrues to the president's benefit, as it would accrue to any president, and so I mean I think that's certainly a fair statement. Now, obviously, there's a whole lot of other things that have gone on that have not gone so well on the economy as well as on foreign policy, but you do have to give credit where credit is due.
We will give the credit, though, I think. First of all, we have to give the blame for not reading the intelligence on what might happen 9/11 when the information was made available to them when they came in office. They didn't take it seriously. But the other thing is that if we get out of this next month and there is no attack on American soil, and certainly we all hope there won't be, yes, he should get credit, but we need to look to see from the record how many threats there were, you know, what actually happened. And Obama and his Secretary of State and his intelligence people will be able to look at all of the threats that have happened, and historians will be able to write about it, and then we will make a final judgment.
You know, I looked at him and I watched the interview, and I was thinking, this man must be pained to hear that his presidency is potentially one of the worst in the history of United States presidencies. Did you get a sense that that is something that hangs over his head, although he didn't directly speak to that, Robert?
Well, he has said, and he said this for a few years now, I mean, particularly when Iraq was in its worst shape approximately between 2005, late 2004 and into 2006 or so. He's basically said that he's looking to be judged not by the newspaper people who are writing the first draft of history, but the historians who are going to be looking at this, 10, 15, 20 years down the line. So, I mean, I think it may be personally painting for him, but I think he's hoping that he eventually will be vindicated by history. I think on the foreign policy front, the possibilities of that are slightly greater than they were a couple of years ago.
Okay.
However, on the economic side, I don't think it's going to look as good.
Well, the other thing is, quickly,
unfortunately,
is
got to stop you.
He betrayed his party, not just himself.
The Republicans will not be too happy with
me.
I love to
hear what Mary has to say, but unfortunately, the clock is telling me that we have to get out of here. So we'll have to hold on until we come back in a week
and
or
I think
so.
I was going to agree with Mary, too.
Oh, God, that would have been worth hearing. Mary Frances Berry is professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. She joined us from NPR headquarters in Washington. And Robert George, associate editorial page editor for the New York Post, he joined us from NPR studios in New York.